Welcome back. I'm Ian Master. This is Background Briefing. And joining me now is John Pfeffer, who's co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's a former associate editor of World Policy Journal and has worked as an international affairs representative in Eastern Europe and East Asia for the American Friends Service Committee. He studied in England and Russia, lived in Poland and Japan, and traveled widely throughout Europe and Asia. Currently has an article at the Journal of Foreign Relations and at the Huffington Post, Is Europe Over? Welcome to Background Briefing, John Pfeffer.
Thanks for having me on your show.
And I guess to a European, that sounds a little apocalyptic. Is Europe over? It would seem in the current context that democracy is over in Italy. The country is now being run by unelected technocrats.
Well, an unelected technocrat is possibly better than what Italy had before with Berlusconi, who was an elected jester of sorts. When I talk about the end of Europe, I don't mean, of course, the end of the continent. The continent will survive. Nor do I really mean the end of social democracy, which will exist in some form or another in individual countries, particularly in Scandinavia, but also in other countries. What I mean is the end of the European regional alternative, the European Union as an alternative to what I call kind of the free market extremism of the Anglo-American variety on the one hand, and then originally what the EU was designed to stand up against, and that was kind of the Soviet nomenklatura or the kind of bureaucratic communism of the Soviet Union. So the EU once represented this kind of humane alternative to both of those, and recent economic and political developments suggest that the EU no longer has that kind of character.
One of the things I find paradoxical about the current situation and also lacking in the debate, John Pfeffer, is the notion that the Northern Europeans, the hardworking, thrifty, tax-paying Northern Europeans, are bailing out the profligate, lazy, and non-tax-paying Southern Europeans. That's a common narrative. And that somehow all of this money that's being required in these IMF and bank bailouts, it goes to these people in the South who have made a mess of things. But the truth of the matter is, at the end of the day, what's really happening here is that they're bailing out largely French and German banks, aren't they?
That's correct. Much of the money that was loaned to the countries that are now experiencing debt problems. And, well, first we should say that almost all countries in Europe experience some debt problems. Many countries are above the 60% debt limit that was established when the 17 countries got together to form the Eurozone. Basically, the agreement was if you went over 60% debt versus GDP ratio, then you were in a very difficult position. You had to qualify for possibly a bailout to deal with your economic problems. Well, that rule hasn't been applied all that exactly, because a number of countries are over that 60% limit. But when it comes to Greece and Italy, they're actually above 100%, which is a very difficult situation. And also their ability to pay back those loans, given what the cost of borrowing is, becomes near to impossible. Which means that, to a certain extent, their debt has to be reduced. Or basically, the people who gave them the money, the banks, have to accept some kind of deal in which they don't get all their money back. However, through the bailout arrangements, money is made available to these banks. The banks provided the money in the first place because largely they made mistakes during the first round of global economic crisis. In other words, they invested a great deal into these problematic mortgages that U.S. banks primarily were selling, and European banks invested heavily in that. And then, you know, they experienced the same kind of shock that other banks experienced when those mortgages went belly up. So European banks thought they were kind of putting their money in a better option when they invested in sovereign debt, in other words, the debt that was being held by countries like Greece or Italy. But in fact, what they were doing was basically providing very good loans to countries without providing any kind of oversight to make sure that the countries could pay them back, to make sure that countries were dealing properly with the loans. In other words, the banks were just looking for short-term profit because they made a lot of money in the fees, in other words, the fees that are assessed when the loans are made. They saw the short-term profits. They wanted to recoup what they lost over here in the United States with the mortgages, and so they went ahead and basically they did a very unwise economic and financial set of transactions.
So John Pfeffer, again, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, currently has an article in the Journal of Foreign Relations and at the Huffington Post, Is Europe Over? The paradox that I see here is that in a curious way, it would seem that President Barack Obama's re-election fortunes in 2012 appear to be more than anything in the hands of Angela Merkel. If she's the main powerhouse there in Europe that has the unenviable task of trying to stop this slow decline in towards recession, which would then create a double-dip recession over here and basically make Obama toast in 2012. The part of it that I don't understand is, why has this long two-year process been so ridiculously apparent that the markets move fast and the politicians move slow? Why, in God's name, have they not been able to staunch this stuff earlier for pennies on the dollar? Every time they dither, it costs them more and more and more.
Well, first I'd say that Obama's re-election campaign is dependent not just on Angela Merkel in Germany. It's also dependent on Hu Jintao in China. So these are kind of the two key figures that will determine kind of the shape of the global economy in the next year or so, and as a result, the shape of the U.S. economy. And you're right, if the European Union tanks economically, and the projected growth for the EU for the next year is marginal, to say the least, less than 1%. So the EU is not going to rescue the global economy by itself. But if the EU tanks considerably, that's going to be a problem for the global economy and for the United States. The United States has been kind of putting some pressure on China, which of course has enormous reserve of capital, to help out the EU, to ensure that the European Union doesn't tank. Meanwhile, ironically, the United States is putting pressure on China as well to alter its currency. In other words, to make U.S. exports more favorable in China and to increase the value of or the price of Chinese exports so that the United States can compete more favorably with China and reduce, presumably, our trade deficit with the country. However, if China were in fact to do that and it led to a considerable slowdown in Chinese growth, that would have far worse impact on global economy and therefore on U.S. economy. So ironically, the Obama administration is pushing for something that would ultimately kind of completely take the legs out of his reelection campaign. I mean, they're just not really thinking all that clearly on this particular issue. To your other question about why they haven't acted, at least in Europe, more quickly to deal with this crisis, well, I mean, there have been bailouts. I mean, obviously, Portugal, Ireland, Greece before received a bailout. The challenge is that it's very difficult for these governments to come to any kind of agreement to cut government spending in a way that, you know, the IMF and the EU would agree to, the kind of conditionalities that are put on the loans. This is a political challenge. It's extremely difficult for these governments to do this. And I think that's been the problem. It's only when the crisis reaches near epidemic proportions in the case of Greece and Italy, that finally governments are pushed to the wall. And of course, they're pushed to the wall and they resign, as we saw with the Papandreou government in Greece and Berlusconi in Italy. It becomes politically impossible, ultimately, for them to push through any kind of reform, if they're even, in the first case, willing to do so. It's unclear whether Berlusconi was ever willing to do so. So there you have kind of economic realities and political realities in direct contradiction to one another.
But what seems to be also counterintuitive here, John Pfeffer, is that when they do adopt austerity measures that are either mandated by the banks or not, this has the reversed effect. Instead of stimulating growth, you know, isn't it Keynes 101 that this doesn't make any sense?
Yes. Ideally, there would be, you know, some kind of an agreement that, you know, as a European Union, regionally, there would be a kind of stimulus that the United States tried to get Europe to agree to back at not this G20 meeting, but the previous G20 meeting. And Europe has been reluctant to sign on to that. And so that's not a surprise because, of course, it's difficult for Obama to convince the Congress to sign on to it here in this country either. So here we have another kind of political reality, and that is opposition party here and opposition forces in Europe in some cases have pushed back against the whole notion of Keynesian stimulus spending.
Well, it feels like we're sort of drifting towards catastrophe here, with Europe adrift, and then that will drag us down eventually. And presumably, the White House recognizes this situation, and behind closed doors, I'm sure there's a lot of gnashing of teeth and screaming and going on, you know. But what's it going to take for somebody to get ahead of this decline and stop being reactive and start being proactive to the point where, you know, the trajectory is turned around?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the Obama administration has kind of followed rather orthodox approach to kind of pulling the U.S. economy out of its rut. Evidence of that, of course, comes from the recent meeting in Hawaii of APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Community, in which, you know, Obama and the United States put forward the president's first kind of trade pact. And remember, all the other bilateral pacts were inherited from the Bush administration. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is Obama's first trade partnership of his own. And that kind of lays out the more orthodox strategy, which is to try to use free trade agreements to cut tariffs, to increase trade, to boost GDP in individual countries. And that, from the Obama administration's point of view, is the way to grow our way out of the current crisis. If we plug the holes that have emerged, whether they're in Italy or in Greece, then, you know, we can kind of move on to this kind of free trade-led approach to development. In some sense, this is the option, the political option that's available to Obama. As I said, the jobs bill, which he put forward, which is essentially, you know, a second major stimulus package, was rejected outright by the Republicans. We might see pieces of that emerge and pass by Congress, but that option as a whole has largely been blocked here in this country politically. Free trade agreements have, in the past, here in the United States, encountered some resistance, but Obama has managed to find some kind of bipartisan consensus on this. It enabled him to get three trade agreements through Congress recently with South Korea, Panama, and so on. So that seems to be the trajectory. I don't think ultimately that's going to work. I don't think that a free trade agreement-led initiative is going to pull either the U.S. economy or the global economy out of its current doldrums. I do think we're going to have to see some significant, state investments into critical areas of the economy. China, of course, has led the way that way with major investments into energy-efficient technologies, into industries that it believes will be kind of cutting-edge industries later in this century. The United States has not done that, by and large. It has a kind of allergy toward picking winners and losers in the economy and directing state finances accordingly. Other countries fall somewhere in between that spectrum, between China and the United States. Europe, of course, falls somewhere in between. The more that we see countries tend toward the Chinese side, I think the greater likelihood that we'll pull out of this particular recession as we identify what will eventually be 21st century critical technologies that will be at the core of, you know, the economic growth, sustainable economic growth over the next 10 to 50 years.
Well, John Pfeffer, though, back to my notion that Obama's re-election fate is in the hands of Angela Merkel. She herself, of course, is circumscribed by her own angry voters in Germany who think that the Greeks are a bunch of freeloaders. And I think they think the same of the Italians who don't pay their taxes. And why should they bail out people with their hard-earned money who don't even pay their taxes in the first place? So you understand that what circumscribes her, and my understanding is what also restrains Obama, is that the recent book Confidence Man indicates that, you know, even the Secretary of Treasury and company wanted to shut down some of the big Wall Street banks, and even the president wanted it done, it didn't get done. Dick Durbin recently in the Senate, in frustration, referred to the United States Senate as the banks own this damn place. So how much do politicians have literally the ability to take these necessary steps? I understand why the Chinese can do it, because they're a totalitarian or an authoritarian country. But
yeah.
So walk us through that.
Yes. Well, this is a problem that has infected the U.S. system, if you will, for quite a while. I mean, it was James Carville, of course, during the Clinton administration, who said that if he could come back as anything in his next life, it would be as the bond market. Bankers have increasingly, as a result of liberalization of the financial sector, acquired greater economic power and, as a result, greater political power. And we had hoped that as a result of the global economic crisis after 2008, that we would see substantial change in regulation of the financial sector. And there were several bills that promised that. But in the end, that didn't happen. We saw only the most minor changes in banking regulation. One of the more recent initiatives is a financial transaction tax. I mean, I think it's a fantastic idea. It would do two things. One, it would reduce the sheer number of financial transactions, and in other words, kind of reduce the overheated market in speculation. And second, it would raise money for useful projects. Depends, you know, who you talk to, where that money would go. But obviously, we need a great deal of money to deal with climate change. So that's one clear option. But regardless of how useful a financial transactions tax is, it still doesn't fundamentally alter the power of the financial industry. And so that is a reform that's necessary, but not sufficient. So I think what we need, and it may not come unless we have another major financial crisis, is a thorough kind of reform of the financial sector and a reduction of its political power. You know, the Occupy Wall Street movement is pointing in that direction. It's funneling a great deal of anger that people have in the United States about the power of banks in the financial sector, but it hasn't translated into a specific political platform. That's fine at the moment, and clearly, the Occupy Wall Street movement, you know, has a broad range of targets. But as we look ahead between now and, you know, the financial apocalypse, which you're alluding to, we do have a window of opportunity to translate that anger of Occupy Wall Street, that knowledge we have coming out of the last 2008 financial crisis, translate that into effective transformation of our financial sector and its relationship to our political representation.
But at this point, as you point out in your article, is Europe over, John Pfeffer? It looks that the 99% will continue to pay the penalty for the folly of the 1%, starting with the folly of these bankers creating the crash of 2008 and the continuing folly of the European bankers. But just in closing, your article also is concerned with and alarmed about the prospect of economic distress in Europe would lead directly to right-wing fascist parties. They're already emerging, noting here that the Progress Party in Norway, to which the mass murderer Breivik was affiliated, is now the second largest party in Norway, which is one of the most civilized, if you will, countries on the planet.
Not only civilized, but also wealthy. I mean, one of the kind of postulates is that economic downturn will create conditions like the 1930s, for instance, in Europe, which produced the rise of Nazism and fascism in Spain and elsewhere. And we do see economic distress in Europe producing those kinds of conditions and swelling support for far right-wing parties, whether it's in kind of these putative territories of tolerance, as I call them, Scandinavia, Netherlands, and so forth, or in the traditional places where we've seen right-wing parties grow in strength, France, Austria, northern Italy. But it's not solely connected to economic distress, as I think the case of Norway indicates. Norway is quite a wealthy country, still gets a lot of money from its oil revenues. And so it's not economic distress, it's the transformation of Europe demographically from what many Europeans would prefer to think of as ethnically homogeneous countries, French France, German Germany, to countries that are very, very multicultural as a fact, as their populations have changed as a result of immigration and so forth. And I think that that element on top of economic distress creates very, very dangerous conditions in Europe. And what we see in comparison to the 1930s, where you had economic distress plus anti-Semitism, today we have economic distress in Europe plus Islamophobia. And I think that produces, unfortunately, a very similar threat to the future of Europe.
Well, John Pfeffer, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Again, I may speak with John Pfeffer, the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's a former associate editor of the World Policy Journal, and he currently has an article in the Journal of Foreign Relations and at the Huffington Post, Is Europe Over? We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment.
Save the money, just say what it used to be. Man, how we used to tear apart this town. Put a dollar into the machine and you